Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Violence at work and what can be done on the legislative level. Protecting immigrant workers, how you can help. And today on the show, how unions can rebuild the middle class. And question, could we see an end to captive audience meetings? Welcome to the Friday, May 13th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. Dorsey Hager is going to be our first guest on the show today. He was a little bit tied up last week. As I've said many times on the show, there's a lot going on in central Ohio, especially with that Intel plant. And that being the case, Dorsey recently went to Portland, Oregon to visit the Intel facility there, which has been there for a good 40 plus years and growing. So we'll talk about that. And we're going to talk about a piece that he wrote for the Columbus Dispatch recently, how unions are ready to build the middle class and how Congress must help keep our edge over China. And what's going on in central Ohio is a perfect example of that. Dorsey writes, Intel's decision to invest $20 billion in a semiconductor chip facility outside of Columbus is a prime example of how a new generation of organized labor can simultaneously help address a dire global supply chain shortage of chips used in everything from phones to cars. And the end result, we rebuild the middle class. These investments in Ohio's innovation economy are grabbing headlines for many worthy reasons. They will bring 3,000 company tech sector jobs to central Ohio and help alleviate national security concerns by reducing U.S. reliance on chips made abroad. There was a time in America not long ago when just about anything electronic was made overseas, primarily in China. We've seen millions and millions of good-paying manufacturing jobs, union jobs, disappear from our states. And some areas really got hit. Youngstown, Ohio, Toledo, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Some of these cities obviously have come back. Detroit. I mean, we saw it all over. Even in the Southwest, when furniture was always made in the Carolinas, that disappeared. A lot of that's coming from China now. Shoes. How many shoes are made in the United States today? A handful, maybe 1 or 2%. That's it. So this is a good way to bring those middle-class jobs back, and Dorsey Hager is going to talk about that as our first guest. Joyce Goldstein will be joining us later in the show on behalf of Joyce Goldstein and Associates. She's been doing this segment for a couple of years. She's got four decades practicing labor law, representing public, private sector unions, fringe benefit funds, employees in the construction, industrial, service, and professional sectors. What we're going to talk about today is the fact that the National Labor Relations Board has found merit in several charges filed by the Amazon Labor Union over the company's conduct in the lead-up to the Staten Island election. That election got union support of 55%, and Amazon is fighting this tooth and nail. They've fired the managers there. They actually fired some of the people there. This is all going to end up at the NLRB, and there's a different NLRB. I've said this many, many times on the show, and you got to salute the general counsel there, Jennifer Abruzzo. We talked about her many times. She comes from the Communication Workers of America. In fact, we referenced her just a couple of days ago with Frank Matthews on her show on Tuesday, and this is what Jennifer has done, because so many times when you're organizing at a company, you get fired, and it takes a long time to get justice. Eventually it's going to happen, but you're long gone. You're in another job. Well, in a recent memo, Jennifer instructed the roughly 500 attorneys who staff NLRB offices around the country to seek to get those illegally fired workers back on the job right away, almost immediately, while the organizing campaigns are still going. How do you do this? By getting a federal court injunction ordering the employers to put those workers back to work. And apparently, Section 10J of the National Labor Relations Act gives that power to attorneys on the labor board to get injunctions when violations of the law have immediate and serious consequences. Jennifer is the first general counsel in at least a half century to use that section to keep employers from illegally firing workers trying to organize. This law has been on the books, and nobody enforced it at the NLRB. Wow, just amazing. So Joyce Goldstein, her website, by the way, joycegoldsteinlaw.com, she'll be joining us later in the show. She's going to zero in on those captive audience meetings. And if you're an organizer, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin has introduced what's called the Workplace Violation Prevention for Healthcare and Social Services Workers Act. That's a mouthful. She introduced that in the U.S. Senate this week during National Nurses Week, which actually wraps up today. The legislation will ensure healthcare and social service workplaces adopt proven prevention techniques and are prepared to respond in the event of a violent incident. AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer and Executive Vice President Fred Redmond spoke at a joint press conference with Tammy Baldwin, along with Representative Joe Courtney of Connecticut, who sponsored the House version of the bill, Gene Ross, President of National Nurses United, and Randy Weingarten from the American Federation of Teachers. She was there as well. And they represent, the teachers union represents a lot of nurses. This is what Fred said. There is an epidemic of violence against healthcare and social service workers in this country. An OSHA standard would protect these workers while requiring employers in the healthcare and social service sectors to develop and implement a workplace violence prevention plan tailored to specific workplaces and worker populations. So that's one to watch. Again, it's a mouthful. Workplace Violation Prevention for Healthcare and Social Services Workers Act, introduced in the U.S. Senate, and it's also been introduced in the House. In the meantime, Bloomberg Law is reporting that a number of investigators at the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division has hit a 50-year low, due in part to low morale, burnout, and frequent understaffing. 32 investigators have left over the past several months, despite the division's plan released earlier this year to hire at least 100 investigators. The total count of 725 is down significantly from the approximately 1,000 investigators staffing the division. That's going back to 2010 through 2013. The attrition raises concerns regarding the agency's ability to enforce critical employment laws, including the Fair Labor Standards Act. Also this week, several senators on the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions introduced what's called the Wage Theft Prevention and Wage Recovery Act. Now, this bill aims to deter wage theft and improve recovery under the Fair Labor Standards Act, including by increasing damages for substantive violations and retaliation claims and enhancing transparency, as well as record-keeping requirements. The committee's press release stated that employers are estimated to steal around $50 billion each year through wage theft, disproportionately affecting low-wage and tipped workers. Is that amazing? $50 billion. You're getting robbed. You don't even know it. Yeah. Yeah. You got to pay very, very close attention. And a lot of this happens with the misclassification of workers. They're wrongly classified. They should not be classified as so-called partners or managers. And I want to talk a little bit about protecting immigrant workers. Got an email yesterday from the AFL-CIO, and they point out all the organizing that's going on in the country. And we all know the reasons. People are doing more work, getting less in return. And we know the only way to turn bad jobs into good jobs and to reset the balance of power is by coming together, unionizing, and also striking. Workers are striking in record numbers and winning those strikes. To keep this momentum going, the Labor Federation says we must continue to rise up and demand changes that will lift standards and rights for all workers with no exclusions. All working people, regardless of their immigration status, must have the right to organize for living wages, safe work conditions, and dignity on the job without fear of retaliation. And that's why the Biden administration must use every tool that it has to expand the rights and protections of immigrant workers. So, if you get an opportunity today or sometime this weekend, go to AFLCIO.org and you could sign their petition calling on the Homeland Security Secretary to announce temporary protected status designations for all eligible countries and to protect immigrant workers who come from countries destabilized by conflict and disasters. And goes without saying, with the previous administration, immigrants have been demonized, and they're still being demonized in this country. And we talk about worker shortages. Well, there's a good example right there. A lot of these folks are scared to even apply for a job because they've been demonized so much. So do check that out, AFLCIO.org. Quick break. Dorsey Hager on behalf of the Columbus Central Ohio Building Trades coming up next.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. By the way, got to check out our revamped website. All the shows are archived there. It used to be AWF Radio, which is still a way to access it, but the new domain name is awfpodcast.com. Do check that out, awfpodcast.com. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency, always connecting people with employment. You can find more at ulagency.org. In fact, they have a virtual job fair coming up next week. That would be May 19th. You can get all the details at that website, ulagency.org. Let's go to Columbus, Ohio right now. Better late than never. We had a little difficulty linking up with Dorsey Hager last week. He's been busy, and all good things are happening in Central Ohio. ColumbusConstruction.org. You can follow Dorsey and the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council at Build Central OH. And that is so appropriate because we're talking about Intel. Didn't even start yet, and they're talking about expanding it. Dorsey Hager, welcome back to the show. How are we doing today, my brother?
Doing great. Getting through the week, having some good weather finally, and getting ready for the weekend. So how about you? How's everything in Cleveland?
Real good, real good. I love the weather, 80-degree temperatures. The trades are happy to be out there. Maybe a little too warm for some of those working on those rooftops, but the bottom line is it's all good. So, Dorsey, I hear you went to Portland recently to check out the Intel plant there, which has been in operation since, I believe, the late 70s. I imagine you had quite a tour. Can you talk about it on the show today?
Yeah. So we went out, a delegation of us went out to Chandler, Arizona a few months ago. We talked about that on a recent show. It was a great tour, a great trip. Got to go out there and see the IBW Training Center, the UA Training Center. Just talked to a lot of the managers and agents and organizers and reps and training directors out in Arizona, how they braced for Intel coming in and all that, and how they got ready for it, not only with the recruitment, but the job training, but also expanding their local unions to meet the needs of Intel and some of the other chip plants that were coming to Chandler and some of the other work that they had. So it was very eye-opening. It was a great experience. And a few stats that are kind of interesting that I shared with a group the other day that I thought might be interested to your listeners that I found. But so Chandler, Arizona was basically a small farming community before 1996. And in 1996, their school district had 18,000 students. They had one high school. They had three junior high schools, and they had 11 elementary schools. So pretty decent sized school district in 96. Then Intel came out, and it was followed up by some other manufacturers as well. So today in 2022, they have 47,000 students, up from 18,000, six high schools, up from one, eight junior high schools, up from three, and 31 elementary schools. So you can see the impact that the growth of an Intel can have on a community. And I'm sure that that's what they're bracing for out in Licking County as well. And I hope that they're getting prepared to take this on. But we at the building trades are obviously heading this head on. We followed up the Arizona trip with a trip out to Portland, Oregon. Will Myers, who's the head of the Columbia Pacific Building Trades out in Portland, very good friend of mine. I've known him for like 8 years. We always talk on the phone, connect, what's going on out there, some of the similar issues going on here in Columbus. And he reached out to me in January. Obviously, we knew this impending announcement. And he said, hey, he said, you got to get a delegation. You got to come out here. He's like, you can't explain the impact this is going to have on your building trades, on your city, on your county, on your community, on your market. So myself, Tim Ely, the business manager of Plumbers and Pipe Fitters, Mark Heinmiller, who's their new business agent, Rich Manley, their training director, their UA lead, Kenny Ruggles, and then the head of the state building trades, Mike Nisley. We went out there as a delegation. We're fortunate enough to get on the inside, tour the Intel plant out there outside of Portland, which was really cool, huge plant. Got to see some of the intensity of the job with the, you know, the piping and everything, the mechanics of it, the electrical, the sheet metal, everything that goes into the construction, the fabs, you know, for the water, the making of the chips and everything, which was really cool. So was really happy to be able to go out there and meet with some of the people out there at Intel, meet with some of the people that are going to be relocating to Central Ohio to oversee the project here, which was really neat. Got to sit down and have dinner with Will, obviously, and talk about our tour and talk about some of the things that Intel expects of us, which was cool. We got to sit down with Robert Camarillo, who's the head of the Oregon State Building Trades, who's obviously been assisting Will with a lot of that work and helping out on some of the other issues there in the state. But like I said, we toured the plant, saw some of the fabs, some of the support offices, everything that goes into it. We got to tour a fabrication shop from one of the largest mechanical contractors in Oregon, you know, has a fab shop that just basically supports Intel with pipe fitters and welders and CAD drawers and stuff. And we got to tour the UA training center and meet with some of the UA officers and ask basically what they do to help support Intel and support the mission in which they believe in and help the community and keep things rolling out there. But there's some new construction going on their plant too, which was really cool to see. And we got to talk to some of the people working on the project and everything, and it was just awesome. And then, you know, come home, follow that up, I saw that CEO of Intel, Pat Gelsinger, was the keynote speaker at the Ohio State University, where the theme of his speech was, you know, an outcry to mothers and fathers and grandmothers and grandfathers that, you know, when your children graduate from Ohio State or any of the colleges in Ohio, they don't have to go elsewhere to look for employment. There's plenty of employment now here and plenty of employment in the future coming to Ohio. So we've got to do what we can to keep, you know, we've talked about it on the show. We got to get kids that are coming out of high school and people that are unemployed or underemployed trained up and interested in the building trades, whether they want to be an electrician, whether they want to be a pipe fitter, mechanical insulator, sheet metal worker, or if they don't want to work on a job site, we can get them into the Teamsters where we're going to need tons of drivers for concrete and stuff like that. But we got to appeal to these kids. But we also need to make sure that we're keeping our kids that are going to school for 2-year degrees, 4-year degrees, postgraduate degrees, keeping them here to work to keep these industries going as well. So that's what we're working on here in Central Ohio, and I think a lot across the state as well. So, but it was a great trip. Really enjoyed Portland. My first time out there, so it was impressive. It was awesome.
Yeah, nice area out there. I hear a lot of good things about it. You know, the thing that's so impressive about Intel, and that plant in Portland has been there for decades, but what we're talking about here is not something that's going to be built in a couple of years. It's something that's continually being built because they expanded on that. They're still keeping the trades busy, building and building and building, and then you got the maintenance factor on all that. Dorsey, after seeing all that, I'm just wondering how you have changed. I mean, you had to be overwhelmed when you checked out that facility and did that tour. And here you come home and you're looking at what is going to happen in Central Ohio. You're probably saying, oh, my God, we've got a lot to do here. I'm just wondering, how do you feel about this right now going forward?
Well, you're absolutely right. We have a lot to do here, and close friends of mine, close family members, you know, my wife, when I returned from Portland, she asked me the same question. When I returned from Arizona, she's like, explain to me the impact of Intel in Central Ohio and the enormity of it. And I'm like, I've been to Arizona. I've now been to Portland. I've toured both facilities. I said, I've been boots on the ground, you know, watching it, seeing it and interacting, and I can't put into words, you know, what's coming, but it's coming. It's on the track. It's coming. It's here. You know, we've talked about it. The first phase is set in stone. We're going to have two fabs, $20 billion. They're looking at anywhere from 30 to 36 months. They've already started pushing dirt around out there, getting the site ready. And they want to put a shovel in the ground and start doing vertical construction before the end of the year. Phase two, which would be fabs 3 and 4, they're pulling air permits and water permits right now, so that'll be an additional $20 billion. And then, like the CEO Pat Gilsinger said in his speech, and he said to the newspaper, you know, the CHIPS Act, which he hopes will pass, and we've got to do some work on that because, you know, there's a few crazies in DC that don't see the benefit of it. But once we get that passed, then there'll be another 3 phases, another 6 fabs, which will take the fab total to 10, which he would like to see completed, you know, in 10 years. But you're right, with the chips and the constant retooling and uptooling and maintenance and the technology, the way it changes, you know, there's constant work on the facilities, constant work on those fabs. We're going to be doing a lot of work outside the gate on infrastructure, not just in New Albany, but all of Licking County. And, you know, we haven't even talked about the other suppliers. And he said this in his speech, you know, I think there's people around the state that are like, oh, well, that's going to New Albany outside of Columbus. That doesn't affect us in Toledo. That doesn't affect us in Cleveland. That doesn't affect us in Marietta. It will, because we're going to have, you know, close to 300 suppliers either grow or relocate here in Ohio. And it's going to be the Honda effect. You know, you're going to have suppliers all over the state supporting Honda. And we're going to see the same thing here with Intel, but it's going to be like Honda on steroids, as I like to say.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Well, you pointed out something in your conversation just now, and it seems like all the politicians, the labor leaders, everybody, yourself included, obviously, have come together in Central Ohio to make this happen. Governor DeWine on the way down, the city council, everybody, because there's a lot of components in order to have a project of this magnitude to happen. But that's not happening in Washington. And we've got a problem there. It's that COMPETES Act, and I know exactly what you're talking about. Let's save that for the next segment, because if we can get everybody on board, you get the locals together, get the feds together in Washington, we can rebuild the middle class, and that's exactly what we're trying to do, because we've seen so many jobs disappear over the years. Dorsey Hager joining us on our live line, Executive Secretary of the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council. We'll continue with him later in the show. Joyce Goldstein is going to talk about captive audience meetings. Could they be coming to an end? It's all happening on America's Workforce. Back in a few.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes La Una to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialist, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And remember, when you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always like those five-star ratings, so keep them coming. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. We'll be checking in with them next Tuesday. Right now, we're speaking with Dorsey Hager, one of our regulars, also proud sponsor of the show. He's Executive Secretary Treasurer of the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council. And the big news is Intel. That announcement came down several months ago. And Dorsey, I want to talk about your op-ed piece here with the Columbus Dispatch on how unions are ready to rebuild the middle class. And that is so important to talk about because we've seen an erosion of the middle class, primarily because of so many good jobs, manufacturing jobs that have disappeared, millions and millions of jobs. And what's going on in Central Ohio is a good example of how we could bring those jobs back in various ways. You got the trades building it, and there's some good salaries in the trades, and then you've got the people working in the facility. So maybe we could touch on this article and explain to our listeners how we need cooperation on all fronts. It seems like everybody's coming together in Central Ohio, but we got to do a little bit better in Washington. Could we talk about that?
Yeah, so I think that one thing that we've strived to do here in the last 8 to 10 years, since we had a turnover here at the Columbus Building Trades, we've been working with business, which we have a commitment to the partnership in One Columbus and also Jobs Ohio on the statewide level. And then we've been working with educators, whether it's Ohio State, Columbus City Schools, or suburban schools, in our outreach and stuff. We've also been reaching out into the underserved communities in Columbus and Central Ohio, communities that have been left behind, even though the economy has picked up. A lot of those people in the community are people of color or females, but it's economically challenged people in our community that are either unemployed or underemployed. And, you know, even people who may have issues, whether it's justice involved, whether it's issues of transportation, stuff like that. But it's a well-rounded effort to get everybody on the same page, to work to get a lot of people who are not living that American dream or that experience of prosperity and get them tied in again, whether they want to come in through a central labor council union and go to work in a production area, like maybe at Marzetti or maybe at Anheuser-Busch, or if they want to come in, get their CDL, become a Teamster, go to work at Sigma, go to work at Columbus Distributing, or if they want to come through the building trades, like we said, become an insulator or an electrician or a pipe fitter or a sheet metal worker. So we're doing outreach to everybody beyond high school to let them know that these opportunities are available. The other thing that we're doing is we're getting ready to step up our programming for not just post-high school, but also for kids in middle school and kids in high school to let them know that if they don't want to go to college or if they don't have the finances to go to college, that there is opportunities for them there in the middle class. And that's one of the things that I talk about a lot and I spoke about in that article, which I was fortunate to get printed in the Columbus Dispatch, is that we've all got to start working together to realize that business needs labor, mm-hmm. labor needs business, then we need to work together to lobby our friends here on the local level, the state level, and the federal level, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, or independents, to get us all rowing in the same direction. And it's like you and I were talking off air. We know it's an incredible problem, is that in D.C., it seems like there's a lot of people that are there, and they forgot the purpose that they're there for, which is to represent their constituents, keep the government running, and help everybody get ahead. And instead, mm-hmm. they're there for their own personal beliefs. And it's a lot of politicking. It's a lot of campaigning. It's a lot of mudslinging. It's a lot of name-calling. You know, Twitter, Facebook, social media obviously has expounded that because it's given everybody a platform to where they can just go on and attack somebody else 24/7. And we're at a real crossroads in this country, and I think that these issues are coming to light. But, you know, we've got to keep working together to get through this. And I think we're going to see a lot of it here as we head in. We're already seeing it here in the state of Ohio with the redrawing of the maps for the state House and state Senate. There's supposed to be some movement here in the next couple of weeks to get some finality on that. But it just seems like that it's very difficult for Republicans or Democrats or even people who have different ideas to come together for a shared cause. And that's one thing that, like I said, we're trying to do on the union side, and we're trying to work to bring everybody together so we can keep this thing, you know, rowing in the same direction.
Dorsey, I'm old enough to remember the former governor of the state of Ohio, Jim Rhodes, and he took a lot of flack for Kent State. But one thing that he always said, and that's why he got reelected, there's three things you got to talk about when you go out and face the people. Number one, jobs. Number two, jobs. Number three, jobs. You know what? If you talk about jobs and job creation, that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. And that's obviously happening in Central Ohio. And to your point, that noise that's going on, you got a lot of politicians that say a lot and they get a lot of media attention. But what have they done for the people in their respective communities? Have they created jobs? I don't think so. So if we can just focus on that, and continue to focus on that, we would be a whole lot better off, because so many of those good jobs, like I've said so many times on this show, they have disappeared, and many of them are not coming back. They're in China, they're in Vietnam, they're in Mexico. But here's an opportunity to seize the moment, and you've got Intel, which had facilities, let's be honest, they had facilities in China. Apple is another one. Apple is still pretty predominant in China. If we could bring those jobs over here, we're going to be a whole lot better off, whole lot better off. So let's just keep on that. There's another issue here you want to get into, the legislative conference. I know you attended that on behalf of the building trades. I heard really good things about it. I guess they were all fired up. Sean McGarvey, I guess, really, really took over that meeting, as he should. But I'd like to get your perspective on that. What's your thoughts moving forward?
Yeah, myself, our communications and outreach director, Kelly Harrop, a huge delegation of our people went out and spent the week in D.C., which it's always nice to get away for a little bit and get down there and see what's going on. But Sean did an incredible job at the conference. So did Grant Booker. They had a great lineup of speakers, of course, led by President Biden. But Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg spoke, the Commerce Secretary Raimondo, Stacey Abrams, Josh D'Amaro, who's the CEO of Disney. Liz Shuler gave a great speech, you know, first female to lead the AFL-CIO. Senators Lisa Murkowski, Chuck Schumer. Leader Pelosi spoke. Tim Ryan, you know, obviously our guy from Ohio, which I got to escort up on stage, was awesome and got the crowd going and very excited about his race coming up. Hakeem Jeffries from New York spoke as well. But great lineup of speakers. Mike Nisley, the head of the State Building Trades, did a wonderful job. We had a delegate breakfast where Tim Ryan and Sherrod Brown came in and spoke. I was also fortunate to attend, you know, I'm a mechanical insulator by trade. I got to attend our luncheon and dinner where we got to honor our outgoing general president, Bud McCourt. He retired during COVID, so obviously we couldn't do anything for him then, but I got to go to that. And we honored him. My good friend here from Columbus, who's second in command at the Roofers International now, Gig Rittenhour, invited me to one of their dinners. Hooked me up with their guy who's the head of the Texas State Building Trades, who just asked kind of some of the things that we're doing here in Columbus and Central Ohio in the state. But it was awesome. The big theme, obviously, was workforce development and our apprenticeship readiness program. Sean spoke very highly of what everybody was doing. He was proud of what everyone was doing. You know, women in the national building trades in the last 10 years have doubled. You know, I think women in the construction trades is 3% across the board, but in the building trades, the registered apprenticeship programs in the national building trades, it's 15%. So still not great, but a lot better than our non-union counterparts. And we're going to continue to grow and do better because, as you know, by 2025, women will make up half the labor movement. So we've got to do what we can to continue to grow and expand. And, you know, there's unlimited potential to recruit and train a diverse workforce, as we're showing here with Building Futures and Driving Futures. And Sean continued to speak and hit on the highlights about how important that was. And Kelly Harrop spoke on one of the panel outbreak sessions one day about Building Futures and the importance of apprenticeship readiness programs and how it's helped, you know, the labor movement here in Columbus and Central Ohio, and helped build a lot of relationships here. So it was wonderful. It was a great, great time. It was nice to be out there. The weather cooperated, which is good because you're not always going to get that in D.C., but we had a wonderful time out there, and it was a good week to be out there.
Very good. You know, you were talking about women in the trades. I was talking yesterday. Marty Walsh of the Labor Department is reaching out and picking up on that theme, and they want to take the building trades registered apprenticeship programs and carry that over to other industries in manufacturing, high tech, so they can concentrate on that and get more women and women of color, people of color altogether in those jobs. Because we're talking, again, jobs, jobs, jobs. I mean, that's what it's all about. But it's not just any kind of jobs. These are jobs with good benefits. And that's exactly, I mean, how many times have you went out, Dorsey, and when you talk to people and you tell them how much you can make in the trades, they go, what? Are you kidding me? I mean, come on. That's exactly what's happening. And I was reading some of the jobs, I guess some of the people that could be working down in Central Ohio could be making upwards of over $150,000, maybe $170,000 a year. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, this is probably for another segment, but we've talked about how in the past, Columbus, because of the commercial industry and stuff, and the size, and it's kind of a white-collar town, a little bit different than Cleveland, Toledo, San Francisco, your more union-density towns. Columbus has kind of been a race to a bottom town. Well, now that's changing. And the reason that's changing is Intel and Facebook and Amazon and Google and Microsoft. Mm-hmm. And they want their projects done. They want their projects done on time. And they want them done safely, and they want them done well. And they're going to pay for it. So everybody, you know, down the chain is going to have to step up and do the same, or they're not going to get people to complete their projects. And I talk a little bit about it in an article that I was quoted in a couple weeks ago in the Dispatch. You know, it's not just wages and benefits, but it's also the job sites, the safety factor, and the way, you know, guys are treated. If guys go out to Facebook and they're parking on a paved parking lot and they're walking in on a paved sidewalk, not walking through the mud, and they're in a heated lunchroom where lunch is provided, some of these other job sites are going to have to step up too, or they're going to be looking around and they're not going to have anybody to build them. So that's just, that's where we're at. It's a great place to be when you represent the labor movement. It's a great place to be.
You got it. Yeah. Let's save that for another show. Dorsey Hager on our live line today. Of course, he is the executive secretary treasurer of the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council. Build Central OH. That's what it's all about. You can follow him on Twitter. All right, my friend, you take care. Stay safe. We'll do this next month. All right.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend. And saw the Brown schedule release came in. I don't want to wish my summer away, but I am looking forward to a few dates on that Brown schedule. And we'll get through the Cleveland Guardians here this summer, and then we'll get ready for Browns football. But I'll talk to you again in a month. Thanks so much, Flash.
You got it. All right. Take care. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Joyce Goldstein's going to talk about captive audience meetings. Could they be coming to an end? That's coming up next.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
Buildings, bridges, skyscrapers, and more. Structures that are the face of our cities and towns were built by members of the Ironworkers Union. That's why it's important that our workforce of over 130,000 ironworkers continues to be the safest and best trained in the field. With 154 training centers, we invest over $90 million annually in safety and training. We're growing the next generation of union ironworkers. There are so many reasons to put your trust in our ironworkers and their employers. Learn more about us at ironworkers.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. By the way, you might want to check out our revamped website. BMA Media, the producer of America's Workforce, revamped this about a week or so ago. And in fact, I've been promoting it on the show. And the other day, it froze up because obviously people are checking out for downloads. But it's awfpodcast.com, awfpodcast.com. If you go to awfradio.com, it'll still work. All right, let's go to line number two right now. Welcome one of our regulars. Best labor attorney around, I call her, Joyce Goldstein of Joyce Goldstein & Associates. JoyceGoldsteinLaw.com, 40-plus years of doing labor law. And there's a lot of people talking about these captive audience meetings, and for good reason, because the general counsel at the National Labor Relations Board says that they're illegal. And when the general counsel says that, we got a lot of people up in arms. Hey, Joyce Goldstein, how are we doing today?
Great, thank you. How about you?
I am good. I'm excited about this. And let's just delve right into this, because this is the focus right now in a couple of organizing campaigns. Amazon, for one, because they've been so good at these captive audience meetings. They've been hiring all kind of union busters throughout their plant, and then they force people to go into these meetings. And let me throw this at you here. Now, when you... I'm going to try to walk down the line here in the middle, because I'm going to play like the employer and the employee. I am the boss. I'm the employer, okay? So since I am paying you, Joyce Goldstein, you're the employee, I can do just about anything I want, because I am giving you a job. So where does the captive audience meeting fit into all that kind of thing? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people wondering what the heck is going on at the NLRB. So how do you place what's going on right now, Joyce?
Sure. So, of course, employers do have a tremendous amount of prerogative over workplace. They are paying employees to be there. But, of course, there are labor laws and other kinds of rights that people have, even when they go to work. And, of course, those rights are more limited than a lot of people would like them to be or believe that they are. But there still are rights. And there is a right when you are at work and you have a federal labor law protected right to either engage in union activity or to refrain from engaging in union activity, to listen to pro-union messages or refrain from listening to them, or to listen to anti-union messages or refrain from listening to them. And that's really what gets us to the heart of what the issue is with captive audience meetings, because what has happened for many, many years is leading up to a union election, employers call employees into a meeting on work time on employer property, and they do it to put forth their employer message delivered by their representatives, could be management officials or their lawyers or consultants. And their message is to persuade workers against supporting a union. And mm-hmm. they deliver that message by talking about how bad unions are, how having a union takes away the individual relationship between employers and employees, about how unions are corrupt, about how employees all be forced to pay high union dues, how they're going to go out on strike, how, you know, all of the parade of horribles that will happen to them if they elect a union. And so when employers require employees to attend those kinds of meetings, the question is, you know, that, you know, okay, you could say on the one hand, an employer is free to say what it wants, but how do you balance that against an employee's right to be free from hearing certain messages, whether those be for a union or against the union? And originally, back, you know, after the National Labor Relations Act was passed in 1935, the original Wagner Act, these kinds of captive audience speeches were illegal. But mm-hmm. then when, after the Taft-Hartley Amendments were passed in 1947, the NLRB had occasion to revisit this issue in 1948, so about 75 years ago now, in a case called Babcock and Wilcox. And the NLRB said these kinds of captive audience speeches were okay, that this was protected by the employer's free speech rights, and they really didn't focus on the employee's right to be free from being compelled to listen to that kind of a message. So fast forward 75 years, and we now have Jennifer Brusseau, the current general counsel of the NLRB, who's questioned the legal precedent and says that the NLRB back in 1948 got it wrong, and that these kinds of mandatory meetings that employees are forced to attend, that they are inherently coercive, and that an employer can't force an employee to listen to that kind of message. So back in early April, about a month or so ago, she put out a memo to all regional offices that says that she's, you know, essentially saying we're looking for a case to address this issue so that we could have the board itself, the NLRB, take a look at it. And and so it's been kind of fun because in this last month, since she put out that memo, again, forcing, really, you know, trying to tee up the issue of whether an employee's attendance at this kind of a meeting is truly voluntary or not. Since she put that memo out a month ago, we have this issue coming to the fore in the two, you know, poster child employer cases that we've got going in the country now, Amazon, as you mentioned, and Starbucks. And so there are now developments in both of those organizing campaigns on the captive audience issue.
Now, up until this point, if you refuse to go, and it's not the full board has to vote on these captive audience meetings, but if you say, I'm not going to that captive audience meeting, is that grounds for dismissal at a company like Amazon? Let's talk about Amazon in this case. Can they do that?
Well, so that becomes the issue. I mean, if they are disciplined or discharged for not attending a mandatory meeting like this, is that an unfair labor practice? And the general counsel says, yes, it is. And not only that, she says that even if you aren't actually disciplined for refusing to attend, but there's reason to believe that you would be disciplined, that it makes that meeting itself inherently coercive. And so what she's saying is that anytime when an employer has this kind of a meeting on company property, on work time, there's going to be that presumption that that if people don't attend, that they will be subject to discipline and that it won't be voluntary. And that's the issue that's being teed up. I mean, so we've got, you know, earlier this week, in the Amazon situation, the NLRB regional office in New York found merit to allegations of employees being forced to attend the captive audience meeting. There were allegations about other people being thrown out of attending captive audience meetings because they spoke out in favor of the union. And these were ULP charges that were filed just a couple weeks before the union won the election in Staten Island. And even though the union won the election, the regional office there is saying it was still an unfair labor practice for Amazon to have engaged in this conduct. So that, you know, that's going to come up before the board in time in that Amazon facility. And then in the Amazon facility in Alabama, where the union lost the election, there were ULP charges filed there also over captive audience speeches. So, you know, we'll see how that case gets litigated. And never mind that, like I said, we've got that going at Starbucks also. I mean, again, you know, last week out of the Buffalo regional office of the NLRB, they issued a 45-page complaint against Starbucks alleging dozens of violations that were included in 29 different unfair labor practice charges. And there, too, the issue about captive audience speeches are front and center. So, you know, these cases are all going to take years to play themselves out, but it's great that finally after 75 years that maybe there'll be an opportunity to say that this kind of activity really isn't voluntary and workers shouldn't be forced to sit there listening to these kind of speeches as though we're in, you know, Stalinist Russia.
You know, Joyce, it's hard to believe it took 75 years for somebody to stand up to this. That's amazing in itself. I mean, we've had a number of union friendly, not as union friendly as Biden presidents. I mean, you think about the Kennedy administration. You think about Obama. I mean, they tried to pass the Employee Free Choice Act under his administration. You'd think that somebody at the NLRB would have said enough is enough, but that at least that day has finally come. You mentioned people speaking up at these captive audience meetings. So you're in the middle of a cap. You decide to attend. You're forced to attend. You decide to attend. So if you open up your mouth and say, hey, this is a bunch of BS, I'm going to join the union. So then you could be in trouble if you do that kind of thing. And that could probably lead to an unfair labor practice charge, right?
Well, you know, it could be. I mean, I think that it might not be coming up directly that you could be disciplined for speaking in favor of the union. But the facts developed in the Amazon case, allegedly, was that employees who did do that were then thrown out of the meeting. And so the question is, when they were thrown out, was that act itself, was that the act that was the unfair labor practice? Was the retaliation against them for speaking out in favor of the union?
Now, one more question here. This is great. Great conversation here. When it comes to where the union can go in or out, I mean, when it comes to organizing, they can do that on the shop floor. And you probably heard of SALTS, where people would get a job at a various locations just so they can organize. They really don't want to work there. They just want to get inside so they can organize. But there's rules and rules on that, too, as far as what they can and cannot do, correct?
Well, sure. There are a lot of cases on SALTS about, you know, where SALTS don't even get hired because of their suspected union activity. But in the situation that you said, assuming that a SALT managed to get hired, someone who was, you know, an active union organizer or supporter, I mean, there are a lot of restrictions on what are called, what we think of under labor laws, the access cases of, you know, what can be done to support a union on company property, on company time. And there are rules that apply to SALTs who are already employed. Those are, you know, different than the rules that are applied to, like, outside organizers who are not employed by the employer. But even if there's somebody who is employed by the employer as a SALT or otherwise, they are, you know, they can typically, except in certain situations, but typically they can wear union paraphernalia, they could wear union buttons, or, you know, depending on, you know, if there's a uniform involved or not. If there isn't, they could maybe wear a union t-shirt. But they are not permitted, you know, an employer can restrict them from talking about union activity, you know, union support during work time in work areas. So you could be free to talk about union stuff, you know, during lunchtime in a lunchroom. But an employer certainly can regulate speech on the shop floor during the course of the workday on work time. So, that's kind of the point, is that employers who have been free to do captive audience speeches have, you know, free rein to say and do what they want, so long as it's not, you know, threatening and coercive, so forth. But unions don't have anything close to equivalent access. You know, it's like letting the Democrats come, you know, campaign for their candidates and keeping the Republicans out, or vice versa. Yeah. There are completely different rules that apply to unions than apply to employers.
No such thing as equal time. No doubt about that. All right, Joyce, we're going to leave it on that note. Joyce Goldstein, JoyceGoldsteinLaw.com is a website trying to dissect a lot of things that are going on in the world of labor today. So you take care, and we'll do this once again in a month. All right, that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up on Monday, we're going to check in with the Connecticut AFL-CIO and the Union for Graduate Workers in Indiana. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.